Hey, Tammy, come on in. We are we're talking about the Jesus touch and looking at relationships, learning how to do relationships from the Master, Jesus. And I told you last time we were going to be looking at John chapter 2, the wine of kindness. And as we begin looking at this, one of the questions that kind of comes to mind in this study. Hey, Dave. Why this particular story in John's Gospel? Jesus changing water to wine. Why was this story included in the Gospel narratives? You know, what is it about it? Because if you think about it this way, it doesn't really seem to fit very well in the rest of the Gospel narrative about Jesus. It's almost like this odd story that's just kind of stuck in there. When you look at all of the other things that Jesus did, and the if you talk about the miracles part of it, you know, he's healing lepers, he's raising the dead, he's restoring sight to the blind, he's all these kind of things, and then he made wine, does it really fit? What gives with that? And someone asked the question, why did Jesus waste his first miracle on making wine? You see? We seem to get concerned about those kinds of things. And, you know, it's also, we tend to look at it, I think, in a sense that says, not only does this story seem kind of odd in and of itself and fitting into the Gospel narrative with all the other things, but, you know, things would be a whole lot easier on us Christians today if he hadn't changed that water to wine. You know? If he hadn't gone and done that, then, you know, we wouldn't have to be defending his actions of making alcohol as if Jesus really needs us to defend his actions, right? But there are those who kind of look at it that way. This story, in other words, is one that makes a lot of Christians uncomfortable. You see, what do we say about Jesus making alcohol? Well, you know, there are those who go to the extent of saying, well, it wasn't really fermented alcohol. It was just grape juice. Which is really a ridiculous argument. You know, it doesn't even merit wasting the time. Although there are a lot of folks who really try to make this a little bit easier to swallow, so to speak, as a story about Jesus and something he did by just simply saying, well, it wasn't really alcoholic beverage, it was just grape juice. And people that want to use this story on the other end of the spectrum to justify drinking and so forth, then their perspective on it is, well, Jesus made wine, so what's the problem with drinking, right? So you got two ends of the spectrum there and kind of looking at, what Jesus did and people looking at the complications of it and so forth. Brother Anderson, you're going to have to bear with me. Brother Anderson says this about the story. He says, not only does this story set the tone for Jesus' dealings with people, it embodies his principal attitude toward human beings. He starts where they are, and he always seems more concerned about the direction people are headed than the speed they are traveling or the distance they have come. Think about that statement a moment. Start where people are. See, that's what Jesus did. You think about all the different encounters that Jesus had with people, and we're going to be looking at a lot of them in this study. But Jesus took people where they were, and that's where he began with them. He didn't go back and say, okay, look, you've made a lot of mistakes in your life, you've messed up, let's talk about those five husbands you've had and the guy you're with now, go get all that stuff straightened out, and then we'll talk. No, he didn't do that kind of thing. The woman that was brought to him caught in the very act of adultery. Now, what was his response? Say, it wasn't, again, a matter of, look, you know, you go clean up your life and get things straightened out first, then come back and we'll talk. No. He took people from wherever they were. Okay? And wasn't concerned about, you know, how fast he was going to get them to be doing what they needed to be doing or anything like that. He just challenged them to start moving in the right direction. Neither do I condemn you. Now go and leave your life as sin. Okay? And so, in this story, it really is, you know, you get through and cut out all of the, you know, alcohol talk and, you know, whether he should have or did or didn't and all that other kind of stuff. This story, really what it amounts to is a simple, practical lesson on kindness. That's really what it is. It's a story about Jesus, the Savior of the world, our Creator, demonstrating kindness. Okay? It is God responding to the human problem of embarrassment. You really get into the meat of what was going on, you say, then we begin to understand that Jesus didn't waste his first miracle, you know, in this event. And he used that opportunity to make a difference in people's lives in a very, very compassionate way. And that's what we want to look at here. Remember, we had talked about four different tools that Jesus had in his toolbox that he used, and we're going to look at each one of those tools as we go through this this story here and seeing how did Jesus use each of those different tools. The first one that we talked about was that he was available. Okay? Jesus was available to people. And in fact, I think one of the interesting things about this story is that I think it shows Jesus to us in a way that we oftentimes don't really think about Jesus. And so what it really says, I think, here is that Jesus enjoyed, okay, underline the word enjoyed, he enjoyed being with people. You see, I think when we read the gospel narratives of the life of Jesus, it's really easy to kind of get into this rhythm, so to speak. We see Jesus and he's going from one event to the next event to the next event. And all of those events involve people, don't they? But it's almost like it's kind of mechanical and Jesus is kind of going through these things. And yeah, he's showing compassion, he's doing good things and so forth. But where's the joy that we ever really see Jesus engaged in his interaction with people? And I think as he's beginning his ministry, we see it right here. I mean, how much more joy do you have? How much more of a joyous event do we have than a wedding feast? Think about it. You say, people come together to celebrate a wedding. That is, most of the time, it's a joyous occasion, isn't it? See? So we see Jesus with people having a good time. And, you know, is it okay if we use the word partying? You see? Because, I mean, isn't that really what a wedding reception is? It's a party? Can we kind of break through some of the concepts and pictures that we have in our mind of Jesus and really envision and visualize Jesus at a party, partying with people, you say, having a good time. You have to kind of go back and and you look at some of the things around this. You know, Jesus shows up at a wedding feast. Well, why was he there to begin with? Why do you suppose he was even invited? You ever think about that? Why do you think, Steve?
Well, looking at his age at this time, he probably was somewhere close to 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just see some, you know, Jewish mother coming up saying, well, Jesus, when do you think you're going to pick a wife? Now, that's a scary thought for most of us. But, yeah, you know, he was there as part of the community, you know, a friend of the families. I wonder if he would have been amused by that question.
You know, some folks have suggested that the reason that Jesus was there is because his mother was there. And it's kind of like, you know, Mary got invited probably because she was somehow related to, you know, the wedding couple or whatever. So she got invited, and so because she got invited, Jesus and his entourage gets tagged along behind. Well, you know, that's probably not what happened, because that's not typically how those things occur. Steve?
It's assumed by now that Joseph was already dead, isn't it?
Yeah, so, by a lot of people. We don't really know.
Yeah, we don't know.
There's no evidence as to...
It could be that, he did accompany his mother in the absence of his earthly father.
Right.
I remember reading that.
But, in other words, can we look at this and really see Jesus attending this wedding feast, this party, because somebody invited him because they liked him? Because Jesus was enjoyable to be around. You see? Rather than this picture that we so often look at is like, well, yeah, he's a rabbi. Well, oh yeah, that's the reason, because he had to have a rabbi there. You see? But could it not be just simply that Jesus, I mean, you know, he's 30 years old, he's a carpenter in the town, and, you know, people know him. He's interacted with people all of his life. It's not like Jesus grew up in a vacuum, you know, and Joseph kind of kept him stuck in the carpenter shop doing his work for him and pumping out, you know, stools and tables, you know, and finally he gets to be 30 years old. He says, okay, Dad, I'm on my own here. I'm going out to the people. No. They knew who he was. What did they know about him? Jesus apparently was a people person. Okay. Can you just see, you know, the folks that are the family members that are sending out the invitations for the wedding ceremony? I don't invite Jesus. You know how stickly he is about stuff, you know. He never has any fun. No. Jesus is at a wedding feast. A very joyous occasion. It's one. Another quote from Lynn Anderson that he says here that I really like. He says, deity descended and partied with people. I like that. You know, God came down here and he partied with people. Because he was a people person, as we talked about. His whole mission was all about people. And sometimes, you know, dealing with people is there's a lot of hurt, and there's a lot of sorrow, there's a lot of misery. But at the other side of it, there's a lot of joy and happiness and fun dealing with people, isn't there? So why shouldn't we see Jesus on that side as well as the other side? We tend to focus so much on so many of those miracles that Jesus, you know, did and that are recorded about him is dealing with the misery of people and healing their infirmities and all of these kinds of things and casting out the demons, getting rid of the sin and so forth. But here we get to see Jesus on the other side, having fun with people. John? Oh, yeah. We kind of got him categorized in this, you know, well, again, he's a rabbi, and rabbis, you know, they're not supposed to smile and laugh and, you know, so forth. But here Jesus is at a party. And not only is he at a party, but he makes wine. Alcoholic wine at the party. Kind of challenges us to change our perception a little bit of Jesus, doesn't it? And I think that's as it should be. Okay? To look at Jesus in a little bit different way. You see, there's no, from Jesus, you know, he gets the wedding invitation, and it's not a, no, I don't have time for such things, I've got preaching to do. You know, kind of an attitude or approach to it. It kind of goes counter to the idea that a lot of Christians seem to have in life, that, you know, Christians aren't supposed to have fun in life. We're just supposed to, you know, do what we have to do and be miserable while we're doing it. Because if a Christian's having fun, then something's wrong, right? I wonder whoever came up with that. You know, who came up with that idea? Christians aren't supposed to have fun. You see? I mean, think about it this way. If you're always walking around with doom and gloom on your face and a frown and life is miserable and oh, woe is me attitude, how attractive do you suppose that is to people who aren't Christians and we're supposed to be trying to attract them, you see? And you go, oh, gee, let me tell you about Jesus. Since I've been a Christian, I've been the most miserable person in the world. Who came up with that? See? But yet I think oftentimes we tend to think more towards that way, that more if we do too much happiness and smiling and partying and stuff, then, you know, we're not doing right. Jesus is at a wedding feast. He's partying. Okay? He's partying. Because he wants us to understand the importance, I think, of us being with people and enjoying life. Another thing about this wedding feast situation is, you know, people would like, I think, to take Jesus in this scenario and say, well, yeah, he was there at the wedding feast, but you ever notice the pictures? You ever seen any Bible pictures, you know, drawings of, you know, the wedding feast scenario? Where do you see Jesus? In all those pictures, where do you see him? Yeah, he's kind of out there, you know, there's those pillars. You know, you see the picture, Jesus is, he's kind of standing between the pillars like the party's over here and Jesus is kind of, I'm here, but, you know, I'm not getting involved in this thing. You see, I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. He's kind of out there. So his mom actually had to kind of go sneaking around to find him, you know, out in the outskirts somewhere. Because heaven forbid that Jesus would actually be mingling with the other wedding guests, right? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Where is Jesus going to be? He's going to be with people. Right in the midst of people. You see, if anybody in life has reason to enjoy life and to be happy, it's Christians. Amen. Right? We've got the main thing to celebrate in life, don't we? Okay. So why shouldn't we have smiles on our faces and enjoy life and enjoy people? You see, social isolation, which is encouraged and taught by a lot of religious folks, was not modeled by Jesus. It was not modeled by him at all. The only isolation that I can recall reading in the scriptures by Jesus is the times when he went off to himself for a time to pray. On different occasions. And after he was finished with that, then what always happened? He came back to where the people were, didn't he? You see? Came back to be with people. Jesus was wherever people were, and he was doing what people do. Why? Because he was available to people. See? Any other thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I don't know if you want to go this way. Maybe I'm moving ahead a little, but this miracle has puzzled me mainly for one reason. It wasn't anything that we've discussed so far, but it always looked to me like it was almost a little bit of a reluctant one because Mary comes to me.
Yeah, we're getting ready to go there. Yeah.
Do something, you know. And,
yeah.
Okay, that's where you're going next. Okay.
And that brings us to the next part here is you know, another tool that Jesus had in his toolbox was sensitivity. Jesus was sensitive, and in this particular case, he knew what was going on. Okay, he was aware of the situation and the circumstances of the need that is being faced by this young couple. In other words, Jesus understood the culture. Okay. He knew what the rules were. He knew what the expectations were. You see, a wedding feast back then was a whole lot different than what we typically think of as a wedding feast. You know, we have a wedding reception that, you know, depending on how much money the parents of the bride have, you know, will determine, you know, what all is there and how long it lasts. Well, back then, you know, a wedding feast would last for days and sometimes, you know, a week or more. And you had people that came from, you know, long distances, family and so forth, that would come from, you know, it wasn't like, hey, hop on a plane and fly there. It was, you know, if you had a donkey or a camel, it would take, you know, 2, 3, 4 days or more to get there. Well, you know, they're not going to spend a couple of hours at a wedding feast and then turn around and start heading home for 2 or 3 more days. They're going to stay there. Okay? And so it's not that they're constantly partying the whole time, but if you think about a feast that's going on for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days, what are some of the things that people that are coming from out of town, you know, to there to stay for, let's just say, a week, what are some of the things those folks are going to need? They got to eat. They got to have food. They need a place to stay. What else? Yeah, I mean, it's whatever they need for their daily life, right? Well, guess who was expected to provide that? The family of the wedding couple. The wedding couple themselves, their family. That was all part of the deal. It was the customs, you see. And so when you begin to look at that and understand the nature of that, that these folks are coming, and the expectation is that while they are there, they're going to be taken care of. Their food and their shelter, housing, whatever, their needs are going to be taken care of. And of course, in that culture, okay, there had to be plenty of wine. They can drink the water. Water was not drinkable like we think of water. They didn't have bottled water, you see. And the water was not, it wasn't in a lot of ways safe to drink without doing a lot of things to it, you see. So for those folks in that culture, wine was just a part of everyday life. It's what they drank with meals and so forth. So there had to be plenty of that. And so to not provide those things, to not have adequate provision to take care of those folks that are coming in and staying for this time, whatever the time is, days or a week or whatever, to not be able to provide that would be, you know, just a social faux pas of the greatest degree. In other words, it would bring not just shame on the family, but it was so important to them that if something like that happened, like you run out of wine, you don't have provision for these people that you invited there, you run out of food, you don't have a place for them to stay, you can become an outcast in your town, in your village, because you have brought shame. That's how important those things were. So it's not just a matter of, hey, we're running out of ice, somebody run to the store and get some. You know. These were the expectations of the culture of their day. Okay. So the issue of the wine is not, you know, as significant as the needs of the event itself. In other words, they could have been running out of food, and the same result would have been there. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying? You say? Because the expectation was you provide those things for them. So what happens then, you know, there is, in a sense, kind of this, you know, understanding what not to do at a wedding. Okay? What are some of the things that would be on a list in that day of things that you don't do at a wedding? Well, number one is you don't run out of food. And number two is you don't run out of wine. Okay? Number three is you don't run out of food. Number four is you don't run out of wine. Okay? You get the picture? You just don't run out of stuff. See? Because it is your responsibility to make sure that everybody has what they need and as much as they want. Okay, so here we are at this this wedding feast, this party, and there is a social catastrophe that this newly married couple is facing, one in which they would be ostracized from their community if it were allowed to go on. And so Mary, she finds out about the situation, the circumstance of they don't have any more wine. Okay? And the first thing that she does is that she sounded the alarm. Okay? Now, think about for just a minute, let's talk about ideas here. You know, Mary's involvement in this whole thing. Okay? You kind of have to wonder, how did Mary know that they were running out of wine?
Okay. As you mentioned earlier, she was probably at a wedding party, you know, family, relative, or something.
Yeah.
For her to know so much about it. And she also knew the capability and ability of Jesus. That's why she went to him and said, hey, don't you see there that wine?
Yeah.
No, she kind of had an expectation of him being able to fix a problem, but I, you know, speculate that she was probably closer to the wedding party.
Yeah, it was probably one of her close relatives. We're not told that, but I think we can reasonably assume that from, you know, the situation, because, you know, running out of wine, again, we know the cultures, we've understood, we've been talking about, that's not something that you just start advertising. Folks, sorry, we're out of wine. Y'all just sit. We got Jesus. Don't worry about it. He'll take care of it. You know, it's like, oh, we're out of wine. What are we going to do? And you don't want to let anybody that you don't have to know about it. You see? So most likely, Mary was a close relative of somebody that, you know, one of these folks is getting married to the family, whatever. That's why she was privy to the information. You see? Now, whether or not somebody said to her, you know, hey, we're out of wine, you need to do something, you know, who knows? It's probably more of, like you're saying, David, that, you know, hey, you know, she found out. And, you know, okay, I don't know what to do, but let me talk to Jesus. Okay. What do you suppose Mary thought Jesus could do about it? Why do you suppose that Mary went to Jesus to begin with? Any thoughts on that? Okay.
He knew there was something special about him.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay. She knew there was something special about him. You know, he wasn't the average child. I mean, the rest of her kids probably got in trouble a lot, you know. But Jesus, you know, he never got into trouble, right? But she knew there's something special about him. She knew she'd been told by the angel, you're going to bear the Son of God, right? But do you think that Mary already had a solution in mind when she went to Jesus? Okay. He wasn't her only son. He was her oldest son. Oh, okay. I thought you said he was her only. Okay. I'm sorry. My hearing's bad. Right. Yeah.
And regardless of whether she knew, you know, what she knew about him being the Savior, you know, she knew, you know, that's my go-to person.
Exactly.
That's my go-to person.
Exactly. How many times do you think, and again, we don't know when Joseph died, but how many times do you suppose that Mary ever ran into some situation, you know, where she was, you know, frustrated about it, or, you know, she was concerned about whatever was going on, and she went to Jesus, her oldest child, and said, I got a problem, not knowing what he could do. And we're not even talking about miracles. We're just talking about everyday stuff. You see, That's one of the important messages. It's the everyday interaction with people. See? What does it say about Jesus that Mary would go to him and bring him a people problem? Yeah. That he was concerned about people. You see? How many other times maybe do you suppose that Mary, you know, had a neighbor or somebody down the street that brought, you know, her stool or her table or something, you know, and said, "Hey, your kids are jumping on, they broke the leg off, what am I going to do? It's my favorite stool." And she goes, "Jesus, can you fix Isabel's stool over here for her, or this table that, you know, it's been in her family for generations and now the kids broke it, and can you fix it?" And Jesus turns to her and says, "Look, Mom, you see all this work I got over here to do? You know, put it over there on the pile. I'll get to it when I can." I don't see Jesus responding that way. But his mom knew that Jesus had a compassion for people. That's what this is all about. You see? And I could see Jesus taking, you know, the tools in his hands and whatever he's working on at that particular time and setting them down and saying, "Well, let me take a look at it and see what I can do." See? Because his mom came to him with a need. But it was a need not just for her, but for some other person. Okay? See?
Well, I know that it's a thought by, you know, many people in Christendom, theologians, that Luke, prior to writing his gospel, may have indeed interviewed Mary as an old woman. And he actually uses language that kind of hits at that. You know, she treasured all these things in her heart.
Right.
So there was a long history, you know, I guess, of the Jesus solving problems or helping things, you know. So she probably wasn't sure what he would do, you know, but she knew he could fix it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he was a resourceful guy, you know, and was willing.
What?
And I was thinking, multiple times I think that honor that was asked. And you thought, you know, hey, they asked me to just come up on my way.
Yeah, hold on to that thought for a minute. We're going to talk about his initial response to her here in just a second, okay? John?
I'm just picking up on that. A couple things. One is, I like the way when he answers her, something to me in my mind, I think about her turning around to the servants and just putting her back to the and said, "Do whatever he tells you to do." You know, like, so she knew he was going, even though he didn't agree to do what she asked, she just assumed that he would.
Yeah.
You know, even though his response was not an agreement.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I've always thought of this, is Jesus was almost, this was like the kickstart into his next step.
Yeah.
And it was maybe God, I think God used Mary to kickstart Jesus into his
Okay, life. Perhaps so. Perhaps so. Okay.
Jesus has been baptized, and the Spirit of God is descended upon him. And, I mean, a lot of stuff has gone on before this becomes this. How much has he shared with his mother during this time? Of what, you know, tell your mom what's going on.
Yeah.
Especially what's going on right now. With this ministry. You know, he's telling his disciples, "Hey, this is what we're going to do." How much has he told his mother?
Yeah.
Which is kind of brought back what she has been told before he was born.
Sure.
It kind of, you know, he can tell you things, maybe give you some advice. Doesn't get you till later on, you know, what your parents have told you. Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Well, what about Jesus' response? Look in verse 4 of chapter 2. You know, Mary comes to Jesus and said, you know, they've run out of wine. And what is his response to her? "Dear woman, why do you involve me? My time has not yet come." You know, we might say, "Mom, I'm not ready yet." You see? And of course, there's all kinds of discussions, scholars, you know, debate that, you know, was he being disrespectful to his mother, you know, and all those. You know, I think all of that we end up missing the point of the whole story. We get bogged down in those kinds of things. Okay? Think about it this way. Is Jesus, you know, Chuck, as you're talking about, you know, he's beginning his ministry here. Do you picture Jesus' ministry as one where he's just kind of, you know, going from one thing to the next, and, you know, no plan, no agenda, you know, just kind of making up things as he goes along? Do you kind of picture Jesus' ministry as that way? How do you picture his ministry?
Well, he has a plan for us.
Okay.
And he had a plan with God.
Okay.
I had a plan to save the people.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, he had a plan. He has an agenda, doesn't he? You see? And you know, he's working out his plan. And constantly Jesus is saying, you know, I didn't do anything, you know, that the Father hadn't told me to do. And so, you know, it's not where Jesus is just kind of randomly going about life and, you know, oh, well, let me see. There's some folks. Let me, you know, there's a plan here. Okay?
But his address to his mother was really respectful.
Oh, I think
so. We take that into context. Because if you go to 19... John 19, when he's on the cross, he says, "Woman, behold your son."
Yeah. And it was. It was not a disrespectful, you know, way to respond to her. But you see, in order to really understand why this story, as we started out this morning talking about, why is this story even here, you know, we need to understand, again, the significance of Jesus' ministry. He really did have an agenda. You see? He followed an agenda. He moved towards a purpose. He had a plan. There was, you know, in other words, Jesus' life was not just a series of random events that just kind of came and went that weren't connected to anything. But his movements, you see, and all the things that Jesus was doing in his life, they were movements towards God's purpose and God's timetable for him. Now, the reason I think it's so important for us to understand that is because that adds more significance to this event. You see? When you understand it that way, then it becomes one where we see that Jesus knew when and why to deviate from his agenda. And that's really what this story is all about. When Jesus says, "Woman, why are you bothering me with this? My time has not come." I think it's a statement that lets us know that, yes, Jesus had a plan. He had an agenda to follow. That his life and his purpose here was not just some random thing that was, you know, he's going to make it up as he goes along. But there was a plan. Why is that so important? Because what it shows us is that since Jesus was all about people, that when people were in need, he was able to put his plans on hold. Because you see, the agenda is all about people. And if you can't put the agenda on hold to take care of, you know, some immediate pressing needs of people, then something's wrong with the whole plan, isn't it? And I think that's one of the important messages that we have to take from this. You know, when our plans that we have and our agenda that we have going on in our lives pushes people to the side, then there's something wrong with our plans and our agenda. Because again, it's all about people. It's not about a plan just so that we can fulfill a plan. The plan is people. And Jesus knew that. And so, though at that particular time it may not have been, you know, the initial thing, but it became the initial thing because of the needs of people. And that's why he was here. Yes, Jesus stopped for a moment from his plan to save the world from sin and took the time and made the effort to save a couple from humility, from devastating humility. something that would have totally wrecked their lives. See? So Jesus is showing to us why it is important to always focus on people. See? It's kind of like the idea of, you know, we're on our way to church on Sunday, okay, and we can't be late. We need to be there on time, and so, you know, we see somebody stopped along, you know, the highway that's got a flat tire, a little old lady that stopped there, and she's trying to, you know, get her tire fixed, but, you know, we could easily stop and help her, but we got to be at church on time, right? You know, we have an agenda. And you've got to stop and take care of the needs of people. Not let our agenda get in the way of people. Is the agenda important? Absolutely. But the agenda needs to be about people to begin with. And that's why Jesus, I think, was able to deviate from the agenda as it was at that particular time, because he knew overall the whole agenda was about people. That's why he was coming here, for people. And so his stopping and deviating, so to speak, from the plan was not going to interrupt and just kind of eternally alter the overall plan and the agenda that he had with the Father. But rather what it was going to do was to bring people in closer to he and the Father by that said deviation. Okay. Peggy, you look puzzled.
I just think that when I was speaking one time, that was one of the stories about changing to wine. And so I got in a can of frozen grape juice, and I put it in the bottom of a steel pitcher. And so when I was telling the story, I poured water into the kitchen, and then I poured the pitcher into a glass, and they all their eyes came over and said, "How did you do that?" And I said, "It wasn't a miracle, but that's the same response that Sherman and Father had when that Christ turned the water to wine." That's how we would think, you know, how you do that, but if you know Jesus, we know how he did that because he's God and he could do anything.
That's right. We're out of time, folks. We're going to stop here. We will continue. I want you to think about, between now and next week, we're going to talk about Jesus being helpful, which is the third of the three, the four tools, rather, Jesus had, and then also that he was creative. All right, so we'll continue with that. Thank you all very much.